Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, business, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on reality behind the news right after this. Hey, are you concerned about your privacy? Well, how much does your government know about you anyway, and how much do you want your government to know about you? Well, government only knows as much about you as you tell them about yourself. Everything that government, industry, or business knows about is because you told them. Now, our Fourth Amendment protects us in our person, houses, papers, and the facts, but it doesn't protect us from ourselves. Now, can we have privacy in the computer age? Well, you bet we can. Information is gathered and stored in a very reasoned and logical manner for later retrieval and use. It's knowing how this information is being gathered and what information is being stored and what information you want to keep personal and private that actually puts you and I into the driver's seat in our quest for privacy. So always keep in mind that no one knows anything about you that you have not revealed by your own hand or by your own mouth. Now, if you'd like to learn more about privacy and privacy issues, call us here at the law school. The number's 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. That's georgegordon.org. Hey, I'm looking at the money changer here, and there's an article that Franklin Sanders wrote. It's called Wither Ben Bernanke and the Dollar. And of late, there's been a lot of hype going on, both in the Congress and from the White House, that's dealing with the downturn in the economy. And they're talking about this double-dip recession. So it's nice to know that the recession ended last June of 2009, the recession ended. Did you know that? Well, just in case you didn't, now you do. See, the recession only lasted for a short time, about two or three quarters. I think it was the last quarter of 08, maybe two quarters of 08, and then maybe two quarters of 09, and then it ended. And that's what they're telling us. Well, now, the truth of the matter is the economy is called the gross domestic product, GDP, and the government is spending an extra $1.5 trillion a year. And that's counted in the GDP. They're creating $1 trillion a year, $1.5 trillion, spending it into the economy, and that's where your growth is. It doesn't have anything to do with producing automobiles or making widgets and hula hoops. If you were to take out that deficit spending over there, we would be in depression, not recession, depression. And I've already reported to you in past programs that the unemployment rate's 28%. It's not 10. The other day they raised it a notch or two. It's just a shade under 10, 9.9 or something like that. And that's true. They're not lying to you. See, these guys are very smart. They're sharp. They're telling you the truth. There are six measures of unemployment, six, and they're reporting number five to you, which is the measure of the number of people drawing unemployment checks. It does not measure those who have been out of work for 2 or 3 years or those that have been out of work for 100 weeks. Doesn't report on U1, U2, U3, U4, and U6. It just reports the U5 unemployment rate. When you put them all together, which is the only intelligent way to measure unemployment, the unemployment rate is officially 21.625%. Unofficially, the real number is 28%, and during the last depression, it hit its peak in 1935 at 25%. So we're 3 percentage points above the 1935 rate. Now, nobody's telling you that story, but I thought I would report it to you. And they don't want to report that story to you, because if they did, you people hit the panic switch. See, as it stands today, three-quarters of us are working, and so on. No, I'm working every day. I'm not complaining about the economy. The only people complaining about the economy are you people out there that are unemployed or underemployed. The rest of us that are working, we're happy as clams at high tide. Now, the reality of it is those of us that are employed are going to be unemployed here shortly. So it's just a matter of time until those of us that are working today will join the ranks of the unemployed, just like they did in Argentina. They hit a peak down there, by the way, unemployment in Argentina, 62%. 62% back in 03. Now, they've worked their way out of that. They're still poor, and they've still got awful problems. But, you know, we haven't gotten to the 62% rate yet, but I think we will. I think we will. Now, that's the bad news. Now, the good news is not everybody will be unemployed, and all of you people that are unemployed could be employed. You can be doing something, even if it's growing a garden and producing your own food. I mean, you could take care of yourself if you knew how. Most people don't. and then they're not about to learn. But I saw this article here called "Wither Ben Bernanke and the Dollar," and I thought I would pass the warning along from Franklin Sanders and the Money Changer. And while I'm at it, I'll give him a plug, because one of the things that I like about Sanders is that he writes articles like you read in the Wall Street Journal. He's an old-timey journalist. Now, these newsletters, he's an economist. He's a gold broker. So if you're looking for a place to buy and sell and trade gold, and you want to, you know, you don't know where to buy gold, well, then this is one source, not the only, but one source. And then I like him because he writes neat articles, and then I can learn a little something from that. And so this story here, Wither Ben Bernanke and the Dollar, it's on page one. Listen to this story. On the 15th of November, 2008, Steve Saville published in his The Speculative Investor, which is located at www.speculative-investor.com. This quotation came from Federal Reserve Board Chairman Ben Bernanke back in 1999. So Helicopter Ben back in 1999 said this, quote, "The general argument that the monetary authorities can increase aggregate demand and prices, even if the nominal interest rate is zero, is as follows. Quote, money, unlike other forms of government debt, pays zero interest and has infinite maturity. The monetary authorities can issue as much money as they like. Hence, if the price level were truly independent of money issuance, then the monetary authorities could use the money that they create to acquire indefinite quantities of goods and assets. This is manifestly impossible in equilibrium. Therefore, money issuance must ultimately raise the price level, even if nominal interest rates are bounded at zero and cannot be reduced below zero. This is an elementary argument, but as we will see, it's quite corrosive of claims of monetary importance." Unquote. So in other words, if the man at the helm of the Fed has enough nerve, he can always find a way to increase the money supply and keep prices from falling. In 2002, Bountiful Ben said, quote, "The U.S. government has a technology called a printing press, or today its electronic equivalent, that allows it to produce as many U.S. dollars as it wishes at essentially no cost." Unquote. Same sentiment, Sanders says. Well, let's think about this for a minute. Let's suppose that we Americans over there suffering from a recession, and we got a bunch of people unemployed. And after all, we would like to give everybody in the nation prosperity, wouldn't we? Now, they have been using a thing here called quantitative easing. They're printing more money and putting it in circulation. And then I wanted to ask a question. I read this article here from Franklin Sanders, you know, and I got to thinking about this, and I said, well, listen, if the monetary authorities, the Fed, the President of the United States, wants to eliminate poverty in America and wants to stimulate the economy and get us to spend them, listen to this, why doesn't our government just write up some, just print up some money and send $1 million to every family in America? Let's quit dinking around here with this $600 billion in quantitative easing and all these programs and bailing out the banks and one thing and another. Let's just get down to where the rubber meets the road. All of us are short of purchasing power, aren't we? I mean, if you're like me, you have to figure out ways to pay the power bill every month. My wife comes in and she's digging around in this jar and that jar trying to find another $20 bill to put together to send off to pay the power bill or the phone bill or so on. And I would like to end that. Just let's put it behind us. If I had $1 million, I wouldn't have to dig around in jars, and my wife's mind could be put at ease, and we could pay the power bill in a heartbeat. And think about how that would stimulate the economy. All of a sudden, the telephone company, having the same problem that we've got, struggling to pay their bills, they would have all the money that they need, because all the people that owe them money would be paying the bill every month, wouldn't they? I mean, hell, if all the people out there in America had $1 million in the bank, well, wouldn't they pay their $75 or $150 phone bill on time? And the same thing with the power company and the electric company and everybody else. And then it would stimulate the economy in another way. We would all have a lot of money. We could just go out and buy a brand new Ford Escape, couldn't we? And I'm sure we all would. God, that would just stimulate auto workers, you know, like there's no tomorrow. All of you auto workers out there would be working full time trying to turn out as many cars as all of us Americans would want to buy. And then imagine all the shopping trips that your wife could go on, you know, down to Battlefield Mall, and she could go in all the shops and stores and just be spending money. I mean, hell, we'd have record-breaking Christmas sales if everybody in America had $1 million. Now, listen, don't tell me that that's impossible. If our government can print up trillions of dollars and give it to Goldman Sachs and Bank of America, J.P. Morgan, bail these banks out, go over here and print bonds and bail out Greece and Ireland, why in the hell can't they print up $1 million for each family in America? Okay. Now, that's an insane proposition, and I don't deny it. But hell, if they can do it for Bank of America, they could sure as hell do it for you and me. And hey, listen, Bank of America ain't lending that money and doing anything with it. And there's another $1.5 trillion floating around out there that business has, and they ain't spending it. And by God, if I had $1 million, I'd be out blowing it. I'd be out there stimulating the economy. Now, going on in the article over here, nothing can stop the Fed. Clearly, Mr. Bernanke believes that nothing can stop the Fed from inflating, and I agree with him. The worry over the zero bound of interest rates arises from the Fed's inability to lower interest rates below zero. Since all of our money is borrowed into existence, the Fed's main tool to tempt borrowers to borrow more, lowering the interest rate won't work when they lower it all the way to zero. Otherwise, they would be paying people to borrow money. We haven't gotten there yet, but anything's possible. Won't the Fed be pushing on a string, unable to sucker more borrowers into the interest market? Well, you know, what they're trying to do here is to get you and I to go down and borrow money. They're trying to get the banks to lend money, and they won't do it. They're trying to get business to spend that hoard of $1.5 trillion and stimulate the economy and get things cooking again. They call it quantitative easing. Well, if everybody in America had $1 million in the bank, would you go to work tomorrow morning? I mean, you know, would you continue working on your job if you just won the lottery? I'm not quite sure that that's going to work very well. Let's think about this for a minute. Remember I said we'd just send a check for $1 million to every family in America. Well, wouldn't that include all of the members of the United Auto Workers? So if you had $1 million, wouldn't you go out into the marketplace and start spending money? Well, if you're out busy spending money, have you got time to go to work? And why in the hell would we want to go to work if we were all millionaires? So it would seem like to me that all of the United Auto Workers guys, now they've got $1 million in the bank, wouldn't show up for work. So you and I go down and we want to buy a new car, and I'm sure that this would work. I mean, the guy down here at the car dealership, he'd be just tickled to death to take your $25,000 and sell you a brand new Ford Escape. And then he would turn around and call Detroit and say, hey, send me a bunch of Ford Escapes, send me a truckload, because I'm just selling these cars as fast as I can get them out of the showroom. And I'm running out of inventory. In fact, I'm out. I don't have any more. And new customers coming in would have to be put on the waiting list until these cars could be manufactured and shipped to you, wherever you are. But I think the problem is going to develop right away, because there aren't any United Auto Workers working anymore. They're all millionaires now, and they're all busy spending money. They're all buying Toyotas and Chevrolets and stuff. Don't you think that all of the goods on the shelf here at the Battlefield Mall would be purchased? And then those stores would call in orders and say, replenish my supply, but the people who are working in these industries, making these things, hell, they're all millionaires. What would they want to be going to work for? They'd want to be out in the mall spending money, just like you and me, wouldn't they? Well, you know, boys and girls, that's exactly what our government's doing. They're printing up all this money, and every one of these new dollar bills that they're creating dilutes the purchasing power of the dollar bills that are already in circulation. In other words, if you look back here, you know, most of you people can look back here 20, 30 years, can't you? In 1980, our economy, the gross domestic product, produced X amount. And a dollar would buy so many automobiles and so many loaves of bread, and it had a value to it. Well, between 1980 and 2000, the value of the dollar dropped by 50%. That's right. In 2000, it cost twice as much money to buy a car. It cost twice as much to buy a loaf of bread as it did in 1980. So if you had $100 that you stuck under the mattress in 1980, and then you went down to the store to spend it in 2000, it would buy half as much. And we call that inflation. Right? Okay. Between 2000 and 2007, the value of your money dropped by another 30%. Just in 7 years, you lost one-third of your purchasing power, which was right on track with the loss of purchasing power from 1980 to 2000. Now, most of us are pretty well experienced in inflation. We've been living through it. We don't pay much attention to it. We expect it every year. They're telling us now that the inflation rate is down, oh, shucks, it's down to around 1.5%. That's a lie at 7, but, you know, 1.5% is what they're telling them. And I saw some numbers the other day. The price of gasoline is up 54% over last year at this time. That doesn't sound like 1.5% inflation to me when the price of gas goes up. And then they come back and they say, well, but see, that's just gasoline. Other things, you know, didn't go up that much. Well, okay, I'll concede that, but still, you know, I notice the price of food. Every time I go to the store where I live, prices are higher than they were last year by 10-15%. And yet Washington, you know, the government people out here, they say, oh, no, that's not true. Because, see, in other places in the country, it's not that high. Well, maybe you people in California in New York and Florida and Texas, maybe you don't have any inflation, but let me describe it here. In Missouri, we got lots of inflation. And it ain't anywhere near 1.5%, which is what Helicopter Ben is telling us. So I can't tell you what the hell's going on in California. Why don't you write me a letter and tell me how low the inflation rate is in California and Florida, huh? Now, the monetary authorities are following a course of action, boys and girls, that we followed in the 1930s. They didn't call it quantitative easing back in those days, but, you know, that's the label we hang on it today. But we've tested this plan of spending money, the federal government spending money, into the economy to stimulate the economy and get it moving again. It did not work in the 1930s. In spite of what they told you when you went to college, they lied to you. It didn't. Unemployment was higher in 1935 than it was in 1931, 32, and 33. And the economy in 1937, the stock market, suffered a dip in 1937 that was bigger than the dip in 1929. The total loss in stock market value was 89% between 29 and 41. And no, it didn't recover until World War II, and yes, the Depression lasted for 12 years. And this one is worse than the last one, and all of the numbers are worse than the last time around. And the unemployment rate today is 28%, taint 10, which is what we're being told. So I thought I would report this to you, and I thought I would report to you that there's a report here in the November Money Changer that deals with this very subject matter, talking about Helicopter Ben. So write this down. It is the Money Changer. I'm reading from the November 2010 issue. And they've got a phone number. I would call them first, you know, 888-218-9226, and say, I'd like to subscribe to that, or I'd like to get a copy of that November issue so I can read this story about Ben Bernanke here. Again, that phone number, 888, I think that's toll-free, 218-9226. Volume 28, number 12, November 2010, Whither Ben Bernanke and the Dollar. And he goes on, he's got a little bit more to say. What are you going to do here when this reaches zero? You know, when the interest rate reaches zero, then what are you going to do? So it's clear then that Ben Bernanke believes that nothing can stop the Fed from inflating. And I think that's probably pretty true. What are you going to do when it reaches zero? Well, no, and the bountiful Ben has shown over the last 2 years that he has plenty of end runs around that. Namely, he will skirt the banks and buy Treasury debt directly, monetizing the debt. If all other borrowers fail, the U.S. government will become the borrower of last resort. It's already happened. It's already happened. The government now puts out a bond issue. And the normal people that buy bonds, central banks and you and me and other people out there, labor unions and government funds, you know, where they're trying to stick their money, you know, for your retirement 20, 30 years from now, those are the people that buy these government bonds. They're not buying them. Insurance companies aren't buying them. And so in order to show you how strong these bond sales are, the Federal Reserve comes in and buys these bonds up. That's called direct monetization of the money supply. They're just printing money, which would be about the equivalent of just sending all of us a check for $1 million. Now, they're not going to send us a check for $1 million, but they are going to inflate the economy, which has the same effect as if they sent us a check for $1 million. And people that have this money, they don't need to work, or they go out and spend this money, and it bids up prices. And we have a thing called hyperinflation on the way. There's a thing called hyperinflation that's coming. And I thought I'd report that to you. Now, I've been reporting it for a number of years. Here's what's coming. I told you about the Grace Commission report, and I put out programs on that. I told you about the Figge report. You know, say, hey, let's wake up and smell coffee here. Now, Americans aren't making any major changes. They're living their lives, you know, like there's no tomorrow, and they're doing the things that they've always done all of their lives. And it's going to come to a no good end here at some point in time. I don't know exactly when, and I don't know exactly how. But we've been through this before. And each time that it happens, historically, there are some differences. In the economic collapse of 1873, it was something different than the economic collapse of 1841. And the economic collapse of 1783 was something different than the economic collapse in 1754. And the Great Depression of 1929 through 1941 is something different than what's coming down upon us today. But there's similarities that come into play here. And then the end result's always the same. It's the loss of our purchasing power. It's the loss of our savings. And then we have to start all over again at square one and go back and rebuild this. And that's a painful process. You know, just picture this. I'm 70 years old. Do I want to go back to age 20 and start all over again working at International Harvester and taking my job, you know, and going out and working and saving one thing and another? Well, no. In fact, I haven't got enough years left to do that. And then you guys that are 40, 50, and 60, you don't either. You know, that's where reality's at. But that's where we're all headed. So you might as well get ready for it because that's what's coming. And that's why this guy Franklin Sanders, I think, is good. He writes articles that are based upon just reason, logic, and common sense, historical guidelines. Here's what happened the last time, and here's what they're doing today. And he cites from guys like Shadow Stats and others. You know, in this case here, he cites from this guy, the Speculative Investor, and gives you his website and says, well, you know, I'm going to go check this out. Go ahead and check it out. But here's what we've done in the past, and here was the results that came from it. Here's what we're doing today, and we would predict that we're going to get the same result. And that's the value of the money changer. You don't get that in the other newsletters. And I don't know that people necessarily want it, but I just thought I would pass it out to you and say, well, if you want some historical perspective and you want a guy that's got some horse sense, you know, just my granddad used to call it common sense, but, you know, just horse sense, street sense. You know, this is what we did before. Here's what happened, and here's what we're doing now, and here's what's more than likely going to happen. So none of this makes sense unless you reflect on stupid Keynesian orthodoxy, which holds that the cause of depressions is not enough demand in the economy. People aren't buying enough. So the stuff builds up in inventories, factories stop making stuff, and then they lay off the workers who make all the stuff, and then they have no money themselves to buy more stuff. Too much stuff, not enough buyers. To the Keynesian mind, it's a vicious circle. And this is what our government subscribes to. It subscribes to Keynesian economics that failed in the last depression, and they have embraced it today, and they are using it to the utmost. It's a failed philosophy. It's never worked in 5,000 years. Didn't work the last time. Ain't working now and isn't going to work in the future, but that's what we're going to do. Now, I think that's the definition of insanity. Insanity. That's where you do something and it doesn't work. And then you go out and you do the same thing again, expecting a different result. I think that's, if I remember right, I think that's what somebody said. That's a classic definition of insanity. All right, so that's what we're doing. Now, am I going to change that by telling you this story? I don't think so. I don't think Helicopter Ben and the Congress of the United States and Nancy and all the people there in the Congress are going to make any major changes. I think that they're going to continue on doing what they have always done in the past. But I wanted to report to you that what you learned about the 1930s, and Helicopter Ben here, he claims to be a student of the 1930s depression, and this is the guy now that's leading the charge. He's the guy that's leading this economic recovery, and it didn't work last time. And he knows that didn't work last time. I mean, he's been studying it. And Franklin Sanders knows that it didn't work last time, and so does Bob Chapman and Bill Buckler, you know, Don McElvaney, Gary Norris, and on it goes. And they've been reporting to us, didn't work in the past, it ain't working now, it isn't likely to work in the future, but this is what we're doing, and we're going to continue on doing more and more of this Keynesian philosophy, this Keynesian economics, spend yourself rich. We've got to get more purchasing power out there. Boys and girls, exact opposite's true. What we need here is savings and production. Savings and production. We need property and property rights. We don't need more of the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. We need more of the 10 commandments. But that isn't what we're going to get. And so we're going to get a result as we progress along. And this result isn't going to be very, very good. Hey, we're at the halfway point, and I've got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and that we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on Compact Desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives. All of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. That's for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling the law school and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Go to the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans. and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the reality behind the news. And in the news, we're being propagandized. We're being told that quantitative easing is the solution to our problem. And they've just begun the process of putting out $600 billion into the economy. They're going to create that out of thin air. I don't think it's anywhere near enough. So I started this conversation today, and I said, hell, send us all a check for $1 million. Now, if we analyze the logic behind that, as soon as everybody gets their check for $1 million, they're going to quit working, go out and spend, which will take all of the goods off of the shelves, and there will be no replacement for the goods because there's nobody out there working. And that's what hyperinflation does. It takes all of the goods off the shelves. That's why I keep telling you, no famines come. Half our food comes from overseas. You wait until you cut your diet in half. You find out what want is all about. Now, that's what we're headed for, and that's because all of the authorities have adopted these Keynesian policies that we did in the last Great Depression. Difference being that in a depression, you don't have much money, but the goods are still on the shelf. This time around, we're going to have a hyperinflation, which will be an inflationary depression. We're going to have lots of money, money everywhere, no goods. If I had my choice as to limited money and all kinds of goods, no limit to goods, I'd choose that over lots of money and no goods. But that isn't where we're headed, so I thought I'd point that out to you. Now, for the moment, never mind, that the theory is completely wrong. Prosperity and economic activity arise not from demand or consumption, but rather from production. And we're not talking about the truth here, but only about what warped Keynesian minds perceive the truth to be. And they truly believe that they can substitute debt for production and that they can create prosperity, or at least they say they do anyway. Now, remember that the Roosevelt administration was run by Keynesians, and they were facing a genuine deflation, a shrinking money supply with nearly a borrower in sight. That deflation was relentlessly lowering prices, so with typical Keynesian sagacity, the Rooseveltians deduced that prices were dropping because people weren't buying enough stuff, and that producers were suffering decreased profits because prices were falling. So, they reasoned, they must raise prices, and they would raise prices by doing this. They would create inflation by depreciating the dollar's value, and they did. And they would let the U.S. government borrow loads of money and spend it to hire crowds of men to stand around leaning on their shovels and building roads to nowhere. They would also raise farm prices by killing millions of pigs and burying truckloads of oranges and wheat and corn and milk while millions of people were starving in the cities. That's the goofy way that Keynesians think. But you know, that's another story for another day. Now, the reality in the history shows us that Roosevelt set out to inflate, and he did. And he did it by devaluing the U.S. dollar from $20.67 an ounce to $35 an ounce. Now, at first glance, that looks like an increase in dollar value. But think about it. It used to cost $20.67 to buy an ounce of gold. After Roosevelt inflated the currency, it cost $35 to buy an ounce of gold. That was a devaluation of 41% in the dollar's gold value. Roosevelt did that over a period of 1 year from 1933 to 1934. Well, how well did it work? Did it put millions of jobless people back to work? Did it send people running off to the stores to buy more stuff? No, it didn't. In 1937 and 38, the stock market underwent a worse crash than 1929. And only the artificial demand of World War II put America back to work, which doesn't sound like permanent prosperity to me. Now, remember now, too, that Bernanke wrote his economics dissertation about the Great Depression. He should be an expert. He claims to be. Now, we can guess that he probably believes that he has mastered the subject. So what might he be thinking? Now, consider that Bernanke is a student of the Great Depression. He's an unrepentant Keynesian. That implies that he has looked at Roosevelt's 41% devaluation of the U.S. dollar, and then he has come to a typically moronic Keynesian conclusion. So why did the Great Depression drag on for 12 years, year after year, after all of Roosevelt's Keynesian nostrums had failed? And what will Bonzo Ben, super Keynesian, conclude? Not that the nostrums failed because they never will work, but rather that Roosevelt failed because he didn't devalue the dollar enough. Therefore, I, Ben Bernanke, the beneficent, will do what the great prevaricator could not do. I will depreciate the dollar even more and make it work where Roosevelt failed. Well, no, I haven't been a fly on Ben Bernanke's wall, but I'll bet a dead dog to a possum that's where he's headed. That's where he's headed with this quantitative easing, too. He intends to devalue the dollar by 25, 30, 40, 50% or more, whatever it takes to get the economy going. And, of course, that won't work because it didn't work the last time and it's never worked in history and it isn't going to work now. Now, that's only my raw guess, but if I've rightly read Bernanke's mind, the U.S. economic situation will only worsen. You cannot get rich by inflating the currency. Or think about it in this way. Can you fly by sitting yourself in a tub and then lifting yourself up by the tub handles? Because that perfectly describes Ben Bernanke's plan. Now, that's the story from Franklin Sanders, which is why I read Franklin Sanders every month, because he's a pretty level-headed economics conservative writing articles and saying, hey, listen, here's what these guys are telling us in the newspaper. How'd that work out when we tried it the last time? And then I sit here at my desk and I shake my head and I go, oh, my God. Can this really be happening to us? Yep. Yep, that's what's happening. And here's the crazy part of it. Americans have bought into this program. Line and sinker. God, they love it. Oh, you didn't care too much for that quantitative easing when it was going to Goldman Sachs and so on. But yep, that's right. They've spent us into bankruptcy, and they're going to spend us into more bankruptcy. This is what your president, this is the change you wanted. Remember in 2008, it wasn't that the Republicans were any better. George Bush, he spent you into insolvency when he was president. I'm not here sitting here telling you to vote Republican. I'm just telling you. And these political parties over here working together, they're working together for the powers that be, and they're spending you into insolvency. Well, they've already done that. And there's going to be an outcome. The outcome's not going to be good. And so you and I, you know, just Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife, we've got to have a plan here. You and I have to do something intelligent. So one of the things, and this is what Franklin Sanders is recommending, you need open pollinated seed, and you need to start practicing with them right now. Now, if you've got 2,000 square feet on your lot, now think about this. I'm going to tell you, all you guys in the city, all you people out there now that you've got a house sitting on a lot. If your lot's 50 feet wide and 100 feet deep, that's, you know, small lot, 5,000 square feet. You got a 2,000-foot house sitting on your lot. All right. So you've got 2,000 or 3,000 square feet of dirt on your lot, haven't you? Okay. Well, it takes 2,000 square feet of dirt to feed a family of six year-round. So if you're living out here in the suburbs and you're stuck paying your mortgage and living out here and you lose your job and blah, 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 you can grow enough food on that lot to feed six people year-round. I just wanted to throw that one out there to you because most people aren't doing that. They're going down here to the soup kitchen. They're trying to get people to give them, you know, food and one thing and another. It's the only thing they know. Put your hand out and take. And that's because they don't know how to produce. And they've been working all their lives. You know, no, I hear you. I understand it. And then you lost your job. Now you don't know what to do next. Well, before we stuck our hands out waiting for somebody else to feed us, we used to feed ourselves. And we did that with a garden. They were called Victory Gardens in World War II. It used to be in America that we expected every American family to feed themselves. Every single one of them had to feed himself. That was priority number one. Every single American family had to produce his own shelter, his own house, whether he rented an apartment or built a house or lived in a shack on the road, Samoa Road. Every American was expected to do that for himself. No subsidized housing, no subsidized food, no food stamps. And we did it. We did it. Wasn't any choice. There wasn't any food stamps. Wasn't any FHA or Fannie Mae. That's what the socialists brought us. Now, the socialism is collapsing around our ears like it always does, always has, and always will because it doesn't work. It's economically unviable. So before this comes down around your neck, I thought I'd throw this one out. If you've got 2,000 square feet, you can feed yourself. And if you're sitting in your house there, probably that mortgage that they sold you is illegal. Probably. Not necessarily, but probably. And then you might be able to beat them out of that mortgage. Yeah, yeah. In fact, there's already been several cases decided in Ohio, for example, where the mortgage in Ohio was declared to be illegal, and the people in the house ends up with the house. Because, see, the bank sold a CDO, and as a result of that, it was illegal. The guy that bought the CDO doesn't own it because he ain't got the title, and the bank don't own it because they alienated themselves from it. So the holder in due course, that's the guy that's living in the house, owns the house. But he has to take it by adverse possession. He's got to be smart enough to go into court and to get a court-ordered deed. It's called a quiet title action. That's another story for another day, but let me tell you a story here about a waste of time. Anyone that's ever tried to break up a pack of yelping dogs knows that the best tactic is to fling a big juicy beefsteak over their heads even before it lands. It'll have drawn away their attention and broken up the pack. It's called a distraction. That's how our enemy handles us. About 99% of the ink, breath, thinking, talking, printing, and publishing that conservatives use is wasted. And why is that? Well, it's because they completely miss the point. You see, our masters behind Washington must constantly laugh up their sleeves. So let's take a look at regulation. Consider first government regulation of business. No question that it skews economic activity away from its natural course, that is, the course that men truly want. It's because of regulation that men can or will enter this business, but not that business. Regulation always travels under some good covering justification. Regulation, they tell us, is necessary to guard the public health, or to protect the environment, or to restrain these wicked evil corporations, or to keep chaos at bay, or to keep your feet from smelling bad. Now, there's always a good reason for regulation. Now, the good conservatives will, like the dogs in our moiling pack above, yelp and bark and snarl and growl at all those justifications that have been sailed over our head. But they totally miss the one object that our masters don't want us to see. Namely, the purpose of all regulation is to stifle competition. That's the bottom line. The purpose for OSHA, the EPA, or environmental regulation is to eliminate competition so the big corporations can have the whole pie. It's to get you and I out of the marketplace. It's to implement that first plank to the Communist Manifesto, to abolish all right to property. Now, the justifications for regulation need not be answered because all are beside the point. Those are merely distractions to keep you from recognizing the authentic point, namely to stifle competition, to make sure that you upstarts do not take a notion that you can compete with the big dogs and so mess up their cozy racket. This applies as equally to the farmer who wants to sell raw milk, as to the jobless entrepreneur who wants to trim trees, as to the manufacturer who wants to make at the corporation's behest. He wants to make a better widget. Competition is sin, says John D. Rockefeller, and so says your government. Now, if you bark at regulation for any other reason, you're wasting your time, and worse, you're supporting your enemy's arguments by biting on his presupposition and false argument. All regulation, boys and girls, aims to stifle competition. All regulation steals freedom from someone. All presupposition and false argument. All regulation aims to stifle competition. All regulation aims to stifle competition. All regulation steals freedom from someone. All regulation is based on the false presupposition that government has power and right to manage economic activity. Any other argument against regulation is a waste of our time, our effort, and our energy. Now, debt is what's going to ruin us. And over my life's course, I have probably read 10,000 pages of articles denouncing U.S. government debt and claiming that our grandchildren will be ruined because they will have to pay it and that the U.S. government will go bankrupt. In other words, arguments that claim the government is spending too much. Well, hardly any argument could miss the point more completely and be more completely wrong. The debt really doesn't matter. What, you say? Why, that's economic heresy. That's worse than liberalism. That's communism. No, wake up. That's the beefsteak sailing over your head that your enemies are confident that you will go chase. Now, as my first witness, I want to call Dr. Ben Bernanke, current chairman of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, who in his 21 November 2002 speech said, "The U.S. government has a technology called a printing press, or at least today its electronic equivalent, that allows it to produce as many U.S. dollars as it wishes at essentially no cost." As my second witness, I will call Beardsley Rummel, former chairman of the New York Federal Reserve, who said in late 1945, in a speech before the American Bar Association, he said this, "Taxes for revenue are obsolete. The necessity for a government to tax in order to maintain both its independence and its solvency is true for state and local government, but it isn't true for a national government." And that's because two changes of the greatest consequence have occurred in the past 25 years, for example, since 1930, which have substantially altered the position of the national state with respect to the functioning of its current requirements. Now, the first of these changes is the gaining of vast new experience in the management of central banks. And the second change is the elimination for domestic purposes of the convertibility of our currency into gold. Final freedom from the domestic money market exists for every sovereign national state where there exists a central bank, the fifth plank to the Communist Manifesto, and whose currency is not convertible into gold or into some other commodity. So it follows that our federal government has final freedom from the money market in meeting its financial requirements. and accordingly, the inevitable social and economic consequences of any and all taxes have now become the prime consideration in the imposition of taxes. Now, he said that in American Affairs, published in January 1946, Volume 7, Number 1. So let's face the facts. If you have a money machine, you cannot go bankrupt. You merely create all the money you need. Taxes aren't to raise revenue. Taxes are for control. Taxes are for controlling you, to bend your behavior, to make you behave in the direction that the government owners want you to behave. The point of the Federal Reserve System and the present government-managed economy is precisely to spend too much, to spend you into bankruptcy. At least that's from your standpoint. But from the owners of the government standpoint, they aim to control you and your economic activity by government spending, which presently pays more than 50% of the wages in the economy. We are now living under an economic system where debt instead of production endangers and engenders growth. Somebody must keep borrowing or the dance stops. So if individuals won't do the borrowing, then the government must do the borrowing. That's why they're spending us into debt. Your government isn't balancing its budget and hasn't now for, pushing 75 years. It isn't necessary, and it's actually counterproductive to the powers that be. They make their money by inflation, by printing it and spending it first. So the government's happy as a clam at high tide. You and I now are buried in a morass of debt, and you and I are now paying the penalty for having borrowed all this money into circulation that now has inflated itself into worthlessness, and we've lost title to our property. And now they're simply foreclosing on it, and it's a part and parcel of people control. Now remember, this is the money changer. The money changer. Telephone number 888-218-9226. Put that down one more time. 888-218-9226. I'm out of time again. You're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. That's for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Our time's up. I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.